muscular and or mustached muchachos, mud skippers, and muffins. This is Good Job Brain, your weekly quiz show and offbeat trivia podcast. Today's show is episode 102. And of course, I am your humble host, Karen, and we are your orating orchestra of original organisms orbiting ortolans.
I am Colin.
I'm Dana.
And I'm Chris.
And this episode is brought to you by our brainy sponsor, Lynda.com, the destination for trusted and trustworthy treasure trove of online video tutorials and courses. I'll admit, even though I'm pretty tech savvy, sometimes it feels like I need to catch up. Do you guys get that feeling?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're getting old.
Yeah.
Things change fast.
Yeah,
I know. I mean, Colin, for you, like, code, there's always new changes to code or a new language to learn.
Or a new version of Photoshop or a new version of video editing.
Yeah.
I mean, whatever. Yeah. There's always the new tricks.
I feel like one of these days I'm going to have to, like, learn how to make and edit videos. Like, I really don't. I've never made a video before.
But
that's
like
kind of huge.
Like,
oh, yeah, I'm
it's
sure I will.
So hard.
Yeah.
I was looking at the Lynda.com site. So I studied architecture. And I was like, oh, there's a whole architecture section. And I was like, what are these programs? I don't know. I mean, I'm old school. I drew with a pencil all of my plans back in school and then made models out of, like, cardboard and stuff.
Like some kind of fool.
Now it's all automated.
Yeah.
It's
like CAD.
So it feels a little bit overwhelming, but fret not. With Lynda.com, you can receive unlimited access to these videos that you can watch from your computer, tablet, or mobile device. And I know we have a lot of listeners who are teachers. Lynda.com has a whole section of videos for educators, like how to use or master classroom technologies to help you and your students. So visit Lynda.com/goodjobbrain to try Lynda.com free for 7 days and learn something cool. All right, time for our first general trivia segment, Pop Quiz Hotshot. And I have a random Trivial Pursuit card, and you guys have your barnyard buzzers. Here we go. Blue Wedge for geography. What 1980 Blondie hit was originally a Jamaican pop song recorded by the Paragons in 1967? Colin.
That is The Tide Is High.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. I wouldn't have gotten that right.
All right. Pink Wedge for pop culture. Cigar entrepreneur Bill Rancic.
Rancic.
All right. Was the first winner of what TV competition? Chris.
The Apprentice.
Yes, The Apprentice. Yellow Wedge. What sort of giant sound did Ross Perot claim the United States would hear if NAFTA passed?
Is it
a giant sucking sound, right?
Yes.
It just said sucking.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. What's that giant sucking sound?
What is NAFTA?
North Atlantic Federal Trade.
North American Free Trade Agreement.
Free Trade Agreement.
Yeah.
Makes it easier to exchange things with Canada and Mexico.
Right.
All right. Purple Wedge. Cynthia Brimhall was the first Playboy playmate to appear in her centerfold free of what? Chris.
Pubic hair.
No.
Maybe it was.
Oh, no, I was going to say the bunny ears, but I don't think that's it either.
Underwear?
It's not about her. It's mostly about the magazine.
Oh. Staples?
Yes.
Okay. I see.
Kind of far.
So it's really more of a magazine production.
Yeah.
Yes, the magazine switched to a glued binding with the October 1985 issue.
That's a good one. That's pretty late, 85.
So that means there's no, like, staple holes.
Right.
You don't need to worry about what's covered up or what would have been shown had there not been these unsightly staple holes.
Right underneath that staple, there's something really good.
They always hide it underneath the staples.
Green Wedge for science. A famous photo of Albert Einstein taken on his 72nd birthday shows him doing what in the back seat of a car?
Is that the photo of him sticking his tongue out?
Yes.
Okay.
Doesn't look like it's the backseat of a car.
I didn't know that.
Seems like a portrait.
Yeah.
All right, last question. Orange Wedge. I'm going to not let Chris answer this. I'm going to let Dana and Colin answer.
I shall put the buzzer down.
Okay, video games.
Name three of the five fruits that appear for bonus points in the original arcade version of Pac-Man. Work together. You can work together.
So cherries is strawberries, one. Orange.
Peach?
Pretzel, but that's not a fruit.
So we're going to go three. So we know cherries.
Cherries. There's definitely an orange.
Definitely an orange.
No orange.
Oh wait. No. Miss Pac-Man has the orange. I played Miss
cherries.
Pac-Man.
Cherries. I think one was a peach.
Ding, 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 ding.
Apple?
Was there a strawberry?
No, okay.
Strawberry. Ding, 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 ding.
Watermelon?
No. Last one was grapes.
Okay.
I assume it's a cluster, not
grapes. Cluster. That would just be a plum.
Good job, brains. Oh, that was a good one. And we have a Lobetrotter fact, a Lobetrotter postcard. Lobetrotters are our fan club members who got the fan club pack last year. They get to send in a cool fact. This is
It's a real Sophie's choice, too, because you made this, the postcard is really elegantly designed, and it's a cool little piece of Good Job Brain memorabilia.
And they have to send it back.
They have to send it back to you.
So this is from Scott and Bailey. They said this. Greetings from Detroit. Detroit has the only floating post office in the USA. Ah. The J.W. Westcott Second Docks, just south of the Ambassador Bridge, along the western shore of the Detroit River.
Huh.
She is America's only floating zip code.
That is cool.
48222.
Wow.
Delivering for over 100 years. And was originally formed to inform ships of changes in orders. Today, the ship duties include mail delivery, freight delivery, and passenger delivery to large vessels. She has even been known to deliver mid-river pizzas.
That's awesome.
I know. I was like, oh my God, you get pizzas on this floating thing. Thank you, Scott and Bailey, for your awesome fact. So this week, our topic is suggested by Colin.
Yeah. So, you know, I've been interested before in things that move fast, things that travel fast. I want to talk all about speed.
I feel the need for speed.
She got you jumping off the deck, shoving into overdrive.
You guys can keep doing that, but Dana and I are not going to do that with you. I'm sorry.
we can try to do it. All right, so I have a quiz for you guys.
All right.
I would say it's tangentially about speed.
All right.
I found a number of words that have the word fast somewhere in the word.
Oh, great.
Word puzzle.
Yeah.
Word
puzzle.
I love a good word puzzle.
So I will give you a clue about the word, and then you guys buzz in and tell me what it is.
All right.
All right. Molly Ringwald, Cillian Murphy, and Audrey Hepburn were all in movies with this word in the title. Colin.
Breakfast.
Yes.
Oh.
Breakfast Club. Breakfast on Mars with Cillian Murphy. And Breakfast at Tiffany's. Mm-hmm. This word originally meant disagreeable, distasteful, and later it meant disgusted. The current meaning, very attentive to detail, dates from the 17th century. Chris.
Fastidious.
I think it's funny that originally it meant disagreeable and distasteful.
Yeah.
Like, people who are fastidious are often also disagreeable.
Oh,
just kidding.
Gauntlet thrown.
That's right.
Shots fired.
Just relax, okay? Just relax.
It's going to be okay.
Come on.
It's just a quiz.
Yeah. Batten, flange, frog, pemnut, treasury tag, and wedge anchor are all examples of this. Colin.
You guys are good.
Fasteners.
They're all types of fasteners. I like flange.
Flange.
Yeah. In Pokemon.
Yes.
Yes. This ability raises the Pokemon's speed stat by one stage every time it flinches.
I have never played
Pokemon. No idea.
Wait, is that a buffer attack?
All right.
I'm so embarrassed. Yeah,
it is steadfast.
I'm sure a lot of the kids out there got that.
Yeah, that's right.
They feel very good about themselves.
Good. They should. A number of people in Christian denominations practice this during Lent. Karen.
Fasting?
Yes. This band was known for their 1998 song, The Way, about the disappearance of an elderly married couple. Karen.
Fastball.
Yes.
Some 1990s music.
That's right. Okay. The 1966 Ford Mustang and the Tesla Model S are examples of this type of car body shape.
That is a fastback.
Yes.
Oh.
It's like the slopey, like a hatchback kind of, but a little bit slicker looking. Yeah, like,
kind of angled.
That's one letter away from fatback.
Yeah.
It is.
Which, there's some fatback right in this room right now that we're going to put into the sausage later on this evening.
So. They're making cheddar sausage.
Yeah.
Good job, you guys.
Thanks.
We took a little detour into sausage land at the end there. Yeah,
It's top of mind.
Yeah, nobody ever minds the detour into sausage land.
That's what she said.
cheddar worst, more like cheddar best.
Oh.
That's for a different episode. Maybe we need to explore the wonderful world of
sausage puns.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just puns.
Just sausage puns. Right. Kielbasa, I don't even know her.
What?
That doesn't make sense.
Listen. You tried coming up with a second sausage pun just seconds after the first sausage pun.
You don't see the links between the two? Oh. There you go.
Mm-hmm.
Slow clap.
When we talk about speed, there is one company, especially in the United States, that is synonymous with speedily delivering something, getting something to you at the absolute top rate of speed.
FedEx.
FedEx. It's become a verb. Oh, FedEx it over to me.
Yeah. Right? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. One of those good problems to have where your brand starts becoming a genericized term and you want to prevent against it, but at the same time, it means you are synonymous.
You are owning that.
That's true.
And in fact, Federal Express, the company, which was founded in the early 70s, really started the idea of you need this thing immediately, and we are the people who are going to get it to you immediately. So when FedEx was founded, its founder's name is Frederick Smith, and he's still the CEO of FedEx. It was all because of the emerging computer world, the landscape of computers. More and more businesses were relying on computers to get things done.
Mm-hmm.
And what this meant was, what Fred Smith kind of understood was that if your computer's broken, then you're reliant on computer parts. You've got to get your computer fixed, which means that this small part, they've got to get it to you fast. And you are going to pay a lot of money to get you that thing fast.
Yeah.
If you think about it, prior to this, there really wasn't that big of a need for you to get something. You've got to have it overnight. I gotta have this overnighted to me. What was the need for that? If you needed shoes for your horse, you know, the guy next door made shoes for your horse. It wasn't like there was only one company in America that serviced everybody. It's like, you know, you got it from your local business and that was fine.
Right.
I thought it was gonna be documents, the urgency of documents. Cause now when you FedEx stuff, most of the time it's, oh, the deed, or I need to get this notarized.
Yeah.
And send this overnight.
And certainly, Fred Smith also perceived that that was something, but there was actually a reason that he couldn't get into that business first, which I will talk about in due time. Yes, but thank you for bringing it up. 1971 was when he founded Federal Express.
Okay.
He had the idea when he was a student at Yale University.
Right.
And he actually wrote a paper about it. The situation at the time was, if you wanted to get something from, I don't know, California to New York, and you wanted to get it there as fast as you possibly could, it had to go through many different companies, because there was no one company at all that will...
No private company.
There was the United States Postal Service, and they were flying packages, you know, by mail. But if you wanted a private company to really, like, you know, courier this thing and get it there as soon as possible, it would have to go on, you know, an air freight plane, but somebody would have to put it on the plane, and then some other company would have to come in and pick it up. And all of these little things would just delay. And so he realized, gee, if there was, or he hypothesized really at this point, if there was one company that owned the trucks and they had a centralized, you know, sorting system, and that they were basically an airline, they would use the hub and spoke system and have a centralized hub. The item would go there, it would get sorted, then it would go on the plane. Then he writes the paper about it and he got a bad grade.
Right.
Really?
I mean, apparently the professor was just sort of like, yeah, this is not feasible. And there were reasons why it wasn't totally feasible, which again, we'll get to. In 1971, he founded Federal Express. He had a significant advantage because his family was rich. Okay. And well, he was actually able to, he had $8 million in family money that he was able to invest. You know, if you want to burn through $8 million, start an airline, right?
Yeah.
So he had to buy a bunch of planes. He had to buy everything else, offices around the country, trucks, everything. And they burned through that pretty fast. Yeah. And in fact, there was a point, I mean, like a lot of startups, they weren't profitable at first. There came a time in 1973, 2 years after he had founded Federal Express, the company was down to its last $5,000 in the bank at the beginning of a weekend. It was a Friday. And what they were facing was they were not going to be able to fuel the planes on Monday. They were not going to be able to make payroll on Monday. And they just didn't have enough cash to do it. They were kind of between rounds of venture capital. They just didn't have a lot of cash. And I mean, you have to have cash to keep the doors open.
As you say, things like jet fuel and running
jet
trucks,
fuel
it's
and
not
payroll
cheap.
And everything,
yeah,
right?
Credit.
Yeah, yeah.
So Fred Smith, faced with this problem going into the weekend, decides he takes the $5,000, goes to Las Vegas, Nevada, and he plays blackjack.
Yeah.
On Monday, he wires $32,000 back to FedEx. Okay. It is enough to buy the fuel. It is enough to make payroll. It is enough to keep the company going.
This man's a gambler in every sense.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, people asked him about it. They were like, you did what with the what? And he's like, it didn't matter. It didn't matter. We were going to $5,000 or $0. We weren't going to be able to make payroll. We weren't going to be able to buy fuel.
Right.
It didn't matter.
At least he's
crazy,
a good
crazy
blackjack player.
He was a great blackjack player, apparently.
It's true. Yeah, $5,000 is the same as $0 at that case.
Yeah.
At that point.
But 32 was enough to keep the doors open. And then that was the turnaround. They were able to make it to the next point where they needed more venture capital. They got it. And then they were able to get profitable. Now, as we have teased a couple of times, there were two major regulations that FedEx believed were really keeping it from like exploding. Number one, there were federal government regulations on what size airplanes that a cargo airline could use. The jet they were using was called the Dassault Falcon, and they were small. In 1977, after like heavy lobbying from FedEx, Congress backed off of these restrictions. That same year, FedEx went out and bought seven Boeing 727s and was seven times as big as the Falcons.
Okay.
Yep. The other thing holding it back, prior to 1979, it was illegal to use another means of sending someone a letter.
Whoa!
Yep. It was illegal to compete with the Postal Service.
So there was private cargo and private goods, but no private letters.
Yes. Yeah. You could send a package via something else, but the Postal Service had a government-ordered monopoly on the sending of letters. But in 79, there was a lot of pressure from businesses saying, you guys, you're not good at your jobs. Like, you're not, we need to be able to send documents, like overnight documents. It's really important. And, you know, it took years, but yeah, in 79, they said, they changed the regulations and they said that a private company could deliver letters just as long as it had to cost at least twice as much as first class mail, or if it was an overnight, urgent overnight delivery. In 1981, FedEx introduced overnight letter service.
And that must have just been opening the floodgates for them.
Oh, yeah. Now, ironically, right now, if you send U.S. Postal Service priority mail or U.S. Postal Service express mail, anything that travels in the air, FedEx handles that. They contract it out to FedEx. So all of the air travel that this mail does, not the ground travel, because that's in your mail trucks, right? But all of the air travel is
which they were sort of forced to.
They just won the contract again in 2013. They'd had the contract for a while, and they just got it again for another 7 years.
Because there's no...
Yeah.
Yeah,
they realized they couldn't compete.
So you see a FedEx plane flying around. It's got your FedEx, and then it's also got
your regular,
your postal. Yeah, any priority and express. So again, as we've talked about, lots of fascinating stuff here. Federal Express, as in the company that delivers things overnight, is not named that anymore.
Right.
And it's actually called, and you've seen this on the boxes, FedEx Express. It is a redundant recursive name.
Federal Express Express.
It's called FedEx Express. It is now just one of many companies operated by the umbrella group FedEx Corp. And the other companies, you probably worked with them a lot too. As we got into the late 90s and the early 2000s, a couple of things started happening that really started affecting FedEx's bottom line. Number one, people stopped really needing to send overnight letters to people because you can just send them an email, right? So that bottoms out. Number two, the good part was people stopped, maybe people aren't sending as many like super urgent overnight documents anymore, but with eBay and Amazon, people are now not only buying a lot more stuff online, the average person is now becoming a small business and like sending stuff out online, selling their possessions on eBay. So there suddenly became more of a need for slightly less fast shipping, for shipping that was cheaper, but not quite as fast. So FedEx, there were two, you know, big acquisitions. One was the copy shop, Kinko's, right? Which they then changed into FedEx Kinko's, and now I believe it's just called FedEx Office. The reason for buying it was not only because, it's sort of the same thing. You know, you're a business, you got to get copies made, you got to send things. It's sort of all, you know, of a piece. But it was having FedEx drop-off locations for big parcels all over the place. The other acquisition was RPS. The ground delivery service that was I used to see yellow RPS trucks.
I've never seen them
out and about. Maybe it was more of an East Coast thing, but they bought them and so that's how they start competing with UPS in terms of the slower ground delivery. So now you see FedEx Ground with the green logo, separate company operated by FedEx Corp. Those two acquisitions were really important in terms of because their revenue transitioned significantly from the overnight business being most of it to
shipping in general,
a lesser and lesser percentage because now they have to do these cheaper things for people.
Got it.
And all told, an average of 10 million packages a day go through the FedEx system. They also have flown pandas. They flew pandas from the United States to China.
Do they call that Panda Express?
They did not.
I thought pandas sat on the
plane. Like the cushion seat.
Yeah.
And then they get drinks and nuts and stuff.
Gonna go
ahead and say no to that. There was a viral photo.
No, they outfitted a whole FedEx cargo plane with a special panda delivery.
I thought that was weird because I saw that one viral picture and I was like,
that was a fake photo that was circulating. So keeping in line with the theme of speed and quickness and fast, I have assembled a quiz for you guys called How Fast?
Real fast.
How fast is it? And what we're going to do in this quiz is I'm going to ask you guys questions about various speed records and how fast certain things go, and you're going to give me your best estimate. Wow. And here's a little twist, is we're going to do this Price is Right style answers. So it's closest to the actual answer without going over.
Okay.
So we'll rotate who goes first here, so no one's at an advantage or disadvantage. So Karen, we'll start with you going first, and we'll rotate from there.
Okay.
All right, so you all have a pad and pen, and you're going to write down your answers. These are all going to be in miles per hour.
Okay, what unit?
These will all be in miles per hour, and I've rounded them all off. And, of course, I will exercise judge's discretion as needed.
Okay.
So, to the nearest mile per hour.
Why you guys use kilometers?
Because we're American.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, here we go. Give me your best estimate. What is the record for the fastest pitch ever recorded in Major League Baseball history?
I am so bad.
Gotta lock in your answer.
Gotta lock something in. Price is Right style. So Karen will give her answer, and then Chris and Dana get to see it.
Okay.
All right, Karen has guessed 114 miles per hour.
All right, Chris's turn.
Ooh. I'm good with visualization, but like speed is such a, you see something go by. I cannot understand.
131 miles per hour.
Woo! All right.
Dana is
guessing.
I'll say 115.
Okay. So you're all over. But Karen is the closest, so we'll give the point to Karen.
No one gets the point.
Yeah. Okay.
Those are your own rules.
Well, do we need an exception for when you all go over?
No.
All right.
No,
that's a the fastest officially recorded pitch was 105 miles per hour.
I almost said 104 too.
Yes.
I was like,
Aroldis Chapman, who plays for the Cincinnati Reds, threw that pitch in 2010. And for our non-American listeners, that is a little bit over 168 kilometers an hour.
Okay.
When we talk about supersonic jets,
Which we do a lot.
Which we do. We have more than once. Of course, that means jets that travel faster than the speed of sound. Give me your best answer.
Okay.
This is not a sports question, so you can't ding me for that. Uh-huh. What?
This is almost like
what
sports.
Is the speed of sound? And I will, for you scientifically minded people, this is in dry air, at sea level, at normal temperature and pressure and all that stuff.
I, like, don't even know where to begin.
What's
I
the forget. Speed of sound? And Chris is going first.
All right, he wrote a long thing.
Chris has written 953 miles per hour. Dana has written 300 miles per hour. Karen, 1,000 miles per hour. Dana was closest without going over. It is, in fact, 767.
Oh, no.
767 miles per hour.
I won, but I was pretty far off.
That's the beauty of Price is Right style
scoring.
That's
right, yeah, exactly.
And again, with the conversion to kilometers, that is 1,234 kilometers.
Oh, 1, 2, 3, 4.
It is, 1, 2, 3, 4 per hour.
Wait, this is good mnemonic. So, like, planes, you think about planes traveling sound, 767 is a plane model.
Right, okay.
Although you might forget and say 747.
Yeah, but you're close.
Yeah, you are close. It's 767, right. And then kilometers is 1, 2, 3, 4.
Mm-hmm. Nice. Mm-hmm.
I think we accidentally came up with a mnemonic there. Usain Bolt is rightly recognized as the fastest human in the world.
Okay.
He currently, in case you aren't aware, he currently holds the world records in both the 100 meters and the 200 meters. So tell me, at his peak in miles per hour, how fast does Usain Bolt run?
I think Karen knows.
And I can give you a hint if you want the average person.
Hold on. I know minute per mile, which means I have to do some conversion.
So the generally accepted number is like a human in good condition can sort of peak at around 23 miles an hour.
Okay.
Dana has answered 32 miles an hour. 80. Karen has guessed 80 miles an hour. Chris has says 33. Again, you were all over.
No!
What is it?
It just under 28 miles an hour.
So I should have guessed 1 mile an hour.
Yeah, right. As the last person.
Well, I had, from a game, theory standpoint, I had two potential options, right? I could guess one, which means that it's under Dana, or I could guess
over.
33, which means that it's between, in that big fat zone between Dana's and yours.
Right,
Or after
but
Karen's.
I just picked the, no, that's crazy. Yeah. That's crazy talk.
Yeah, at 80 miles an hour, he would be faster than a cheetah. And once more, the kilometer conversion, that would be just under 45 kilometers an hour.
I really appreciate your kilometer conversion for me.
Because you're so continental.
Got it.
I know miles because that's the distance I run in.
Yeah.
But in terms of, scaling it for cars and planes, I have no idea.
Oh, interesting.
According to Guinness World Records, how fast is the fastest production car in the world?
Production, what does that mean?
So production car means we're not talking about a one-off Formula One racer or something like that. So production car has a very specific definition in terms of Guinness's rules. Like, this is a car that if you had enough money, you could buy one of these. I mean, it's got to pass emissions test. It's got to have, headlights and turn signals. And also, one other stipulation is it has to be a car that there are 30 of them produced, This is sort of to get around companies producing cars just to break this speed record. So to the nearest mile per hour, how fast? Now, these are super performance, super expensive cars.
Mm-hmm.
Way faster than you and I ever drive. Karen has guessed 130 miles an hour.
Okay.
Chris has guessed 218 miles per hour.
$1.
Dana's going.
Yeah,
there you go.
Yep.
Dana's guessed 131 miles an hour. Chris is closest. And even Chris is still below by a good bit.
Yeah.
The Guinness recognizes the Bugatti Veyron Supersport as the world's fastest production car with a recorded top peak speed of 268 miles per hour. Now, when they do these speed tests, they do these on, like, landing strips.
Yeah.
And, I mean, because they need that much space to get up to speed. Mm-hmm. And this record actually is not without a little bit of controversy. Just last month, this past February...
Did the car take steroids?
The Hennessy boutique car manufacturer, they make a car called the Venom. The Hennessy Venom GT recorded a peak speed of 270 miles per hour at a speed test at the Kennedy Space Center on the runway where they land the space shuttles, So even though it did peak faster, it doesn't qualify for the Guinness record for two reasons. One,
production.
They're not making enough of them to hit the production level limit.
Okay.
They're just making below that number. And also, Guinness requires you do two runs in both directions, and then they average them out.
Oh, that's smart.
To cancel out any wind effects or anything like that. And unfortunately, the Hennessy people, they were only able to secure enough time to do one length of a race. NASA wouldn't let them do another race the other direction.
Oh, yeah, because they got a space shuttle.
Yeah.
Well, folks, we're about to get runway clearance. There is a sports car on the runway, but we've been told we're next in line.
Yeah, we're just going to circle around one time. Just sit tight. And that speed record, again, converted to kilometers, is 431 kilometers an hour.
What about Usain Bolt driving one of those?
Whoa.
With a cheetah in the trunk. Wait, I guess that wouldn't make it faster. Yeah.
What if there was a plane going the speed of sound, and then Usain Bolt was in the car at the back of the plane, and then drove forward in the plane?
With the cheetah.
With the cheetah.
That's right.
How fast does the Earth rotate?
Hmm.
By which I mean at the equator... relative to its axis.
Science facts you're supposed to know.
How fast
man.
Does the Earth rotate?
I can almost hear people yelling at us in the car.
We had
like
this
they
question
know.
Before.
Yeah.
We have talked about this, right? And again, this is one where if you had the right, I mean, you have one piece of data, you know a day is 24 hours. So you really just need to know the circumference of the Earth to kind of back
Wait,
this
it's
out.
Not your...
So who's up first? Chris is up. Chris has answered 97,580 miles per hour. Dana said 1 mile an hour.
I
All
say
right.
$1.
Karen.
And Karen.
No!
Oh.
You gotta go $2.
What is it?
Karen, I think you should have stuck with what you originally had.
Okay, hold on. I remember it's one and a bunch of zeros. It's either six zeros or four zeros. Either 1,000 or 10,000. That's
put
how
100,000.
Karen put 100,000.
Uh-huh.
That's the answer.
The answer is 1,000 miles an hour.
I got it!
Oh, yep.
That was my
I
first
told
answer.
You! Put $2. You're not game theorying this thing.
It's actually slightly over 1,000 miles an hour, but yeah, the circumference of circumference of the Earth at the equator is just under 25,000 miles. And again, lastly, that is 1,600 kilometers an hour, a little bit over. How fast the Earth
Dana
rotates.
Dana didn't even put the right unit. She said $1, not even miles per hour.
Dollar a mile.
$1 a mile.
This is the good and the bad of Price is Right style scoring.
Yeah.
Good job, guys. Well done.
Wow, thanks.
Thank you. All right, let's take a quick ad break. A word from our sponsor.
What do you want to learn today? Photography? Coding? Leadership? With the easy-to-follow video tutorials on lynda.com, you can learn at your own pace, on your own terms. Our top industry instructors don't just tell you how to get it done, they show you.
I'll set a shadow point here, and then I'll drag it up. Notice that elevates the shadows.
Head out to the desert with a seasoned photographer. Record a song with a world-class producer. Build your own app with a top-tier coder. With over 2,000 courses and more added weekly, there's no end to what you can learn at lynda.com. So, what do you want to learn first?
Welcome back. You're listening to Good Job Brain. And this week we're talking about things that are speedy, things that are fast, and things that are instant. All right, I'm going to ask you guys this question first. According to a poll in the year 2000, the Japanese believed that their best invention of the 20th century was what? 20th.
Instant noodles.
Yes!
Oh, okay.
Darn it! I thought people were going to be like, oh, it's the Shinkansen train or whatever. You got it. Instant noodles.
Yeah.
The instant noodles we know here in America mostly are the Nissin cup noodles.
Yeah. You
know,
or like Maruchan, the sort of like brick of noodles.
In
yeah.
a plastic
yeah.
bag.
Mm-hmm. Right, cup yeah. of noodles. And cup and then ramen. That's it. Yeah. That's it. Those are the only two.
Back in Taiwan growing up, the variety is insane yeah. and mm-hmm. it's fancy. Things get oh. fancy. It's still cheap.
Like but what? Like,
they actually can add meat. And meat is in like stewed meat in a pouch oh. that you can open and put over your noodles. I grew up really liking the weird kind of Chinese herbal medicine flavored noodles. Huh. The noodles themselves, like they range from vermicelli, they range from egg noodles, but I mean, they're all instant. I would say that was one of the disappointments of coming here in America. I was like, well, you guys just have these cup kinds or my fancy kinds.
Sorry, they're in Japan.
They're also in Japan too, yeah. So instant noodles were actually invented by a Taiwanese person
oh, really?
In Japan. The inventor, his Chinese name is Hu Bai Fu. He changed his name when he moved to Japan.
To Johnny Noodles.
To Johnny I Noodles. Okay. I for instant.
Yeah.
This is back when Taiwan was still, well, was under Japanese occupation. There are a lot of people who, yep, people who would move to Japan or Japan moved to Taiwan, and he had a Japanese name. It was actually a literal translation of his Chinese name, which literally translates to 100 prosperity or 100 luck. His Japanese name also literally meant that from his Chinese name, which is Momofuku.
Oh, okay.
His name is Momofuku Ando. That's his Japanese name. And you might know Momofuku because that is celebrity chef David Chang and his ramen restaurant and Asian restaurants in New York City. Yeah. It's called Momofuku.
Yeah, I had no idea that was the connection.
Also means lucky peach.
100 luck. Yeah. Well, that's what I thought it meant. Lucky peach, right?
But it was a nod to the inventor of ramen.
Wow. Yeah.
Or instant noodles. This is how it works. So you have the noodle dough, pretty basic, you know, starch and water, extrude it out into noodle form, and the fresh noodles made is basically dunked and flash fried in oil. And that's the quote cooking process. And the noodles themselves, they're dried from the flash frying process, goes from your average kind of moisture content of 30% to 50% after frying to 5%.
Whoa.
Mm. Okay.
That's a lot. Taking the flash fry really takes a lot of the water out. And this is why a lot of people say that it's not very healthy, which it isn't. It has a high starch content and a high oil content.
Because I don't basically think I knew that they were, fried.
You're eating a soggy fried food.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
what you're
yeah.
eating.
Yeah.
You're like, oh, it's boiling noodles. It's no, you're putting water in a
noodle,
fried
it's
item.
Flour and water now.
Yeah. Nope. Deep fried. And in 2005, instant noodles in space. They modified instant noodles for astronauts, and it's called Space Ram, or I guess Space Rom.
Space Rom.
Space Rom.
Like space Ramen.
Oh, I see.
But
I
they
see.
Call it Space Rom.
Space Rom.
Which is Space
Ram. They didn't
Ram.
Really understand like where the breaks in that word occurred. Yeah.
Space Ram. The modifications are clever. So, you know, when we have instant noodles, it's usually a brick or a big chunk, right? They made little balls of ramen. They separated big chunks into little balls. They had to make the soup thicker so that it wouldn't spill in space or it wouldn't be messy in space. They modified the starch content in the noodles so that it can be cooked with not boiling water. Cooked with hot water, but not boiling water, water cannot boil in space.
Mm.
So they had to come up with a way that you can cook the noodles a lower temperature water. I looked at pictures for this. Doesn't look very good, but I think most astronaut food doesn't look very good.
Most space food, it's not about the presentation.
And of course, in addition to Asia, instant noodles are super popular in countries like Nigeria and Brazil and Mexico. This is why this is one of the best inventions of the 20th century, because it's cheap, it is satisfying, it has enough calories in it. For a lot of countries, this really helps with their hunger problem.
It doesn't go bad sitting on the shelf.
It doesn't go bad. Yeah, it can last for a while. Mm. And one of the experts say that they're cheap, they're tasty, and they're tweakable. And that's a thing.
I mean,
And therefore, you can change the flavors for a lot of different countries according to their own taste.
That's right, mm-hmm.
In Brazil, the really popular flavors are four cheese and tomato bacon.
Delicious.
That sounds good.
And for us, it seems kind of weird. Like, whoa.
Not to me, it doesn't.
I was like, yeah, why not?
Because you're so used to like chicken or beef or seafood. Oh. Right. Like a little bit like out
shrimp
there.
Or something, right?
Yeah. And I got one last fact. Oh, actually, a question for you guys. Per capita, what country consumes the greatest amount of instant noodles? Like, what's your theory of guessing?
Well, my theory of guessing is that it's a trick, but I'll go with the obvious answer. I'll guess Japan.
I was going to guess Japan, but how about Taiwan?
I guess the U.S. because we eat so much.
It is South Korea.
Okay.
So in between. Close. They, I mean, in between Japan and Taiwan. You know, somewhere there.
One hand on the mouse, the other hand on the noodles.
There's a lot of really good noodles, though. Korean style ramen.
Yeah.
The kimchi flavor.
You know what? I bet the StarCraft thing, I would love to see like some sort of study about like esports and gaming and instant food.
What do people eat when they eat?
Well, I associate ramen as a gamer food. Like, I mean, here, I just.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
That to me is.
College food.
In America. It's true. It's both. It's both. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I'm assuming that you guys have all seen the classic 1980s movie, The Cannonball Run.
You know what happens when you assume?
It makes
Colin,
an ass out of me.
Out of you and Umption.
Yeah. Yeah. Nobody, no one here has seen it.
I don't even know what the movie is.
I know
is
what
about.
It is, but I okay. Sadly.
Does it have Burt Reynolds?
It does and have Burt Reynolds.
Dagny Coleman?
Dom DeLuise?
Yes!
That's what you're thinking of. You're making the classic Dabney Coleman Dom DeLuise speech.
I'm just like, I remember bright colors and cars and like people finding things funny that I didn't understand. Like, I remember this movie. Like,
okay, all right.
And you just described
so now we know when
have,
we saw it. Yeah.
I've never heard of this and have no idea what it is.
The premise of the movie is a coast-to-coast auto race.
Yeah.
It's an all-star cast. As you say, Burt Reynolds, Dom DeLuise, Dean Martin, Sammy Davis Jr., Jackie Chan is one of the racers in the movie, Terry Bradshaw, Roger Moore.
Wait, Terry Bradshaw, the football player?
Yes, Terry Bradshaw, the football player, and budding actor at one point. Yeah. And the plot of the movie was about a group of racers racing from Connecticut to California, and of course the hijinks that ensue along the way.
Oh, that actually sounds fun.
And illegal.
Yes, highly illegal, yes.
When did it come out?
1981. It was an absolute smash hit at the box office. It was the sixth highest grossing movie of 1981. There were sequels to it. It spawned a whole sort of genre of wacky auto race movies and stories. Now, what you may not know, even if you've seen the movie several times, is that the Cannonball Run was directly inspired by a real-life coast-to-coast race of the same name. Several times over the course of the 1970s, they ran Cannonball Baker Sea to Shining Sea Memorial Trophy Dash. Informally, it was just called the Cannonball Run. So let's back up a bit.
Okay.
Let me tell you about Irwin Baker. Irwin Baker was a race driver and kind of all-around gearhead vehicle nut. From the 1910s to the 1930s, he set dozens and dozens and dozens of driving records. And he was particularly interested in cross-country distance driving records. In 1915, he drove a Stutz Bearcat from L.A. to New York City, just a little bit over 11 days. Over the course of the years, he got that record down to a week. And I want to point out this was before the interstate highway system. Okay,
so
this is on regular city roads, maybe a two-lane highway here and there. Yeah, so just to put it in perspective.
Okay. Does he sleep?
He would sleep on the multi-day trips, yeah, certainly. He did get to the point, though, where he was trying to go essentially nonstop, like just stopping up just to gas or,
so
you know.
So dangerous.
I know.
For everybody,
There are...
That means he pees in a seat.
You can... it does not necessarily
mean...
You can
pause for a minute.
Yeah.
You can pause
for a
moment.
Stop and pull over and pee by the side of the road.
But they're not sleeping at all.
I'm sure he loved that car. He wouldn't just fill it with the smell of human urine.
The peak of his achievements was his 1933 drive, where he went from New York City to San Francisco in 53 and a half hours.
Wow.
Zooming.
Were there any national speed limits at that point
this
in
was,
the 30s?
This predated national speed limits. Yeah, by
sure.
decades.
Sure. Yeah.
Right, which helps, of course.
The car established its own speed limit because it couldn't go that much faster.
You're right. And this was the drive that would later inspire the Cannonball Run, named in his honor. So the first Cannonball Run was in 1971, and it was conceived by a guy named Brock Yates, who was a racer and a writer. He wrote for Car and Driver, and Steve Smith, who also was affiliated with Car and Driver magazine. And they came up with the idea of, you know what, let's stage a grand spectacle of a coast-to-coast race, kind of to sort of celebrate the fact that we do now have an interstate highway system, and we'll write about it, and we'll cover it in Car and Driver magazine.
But it's still illegal?
It is still highly, highly illegal. So when you do these races, you kind of have to do it on the down low. You don't publicize it until after you're done. So there was only one team running the run the first year. And over the course of the 70s, as it got more and more publicized and popularized, the number of teams grew. The rules were pretty much wide open. You could take any route you want. You could drive however fast you feel is necessary, any type of vehicle you want. Speeding tickets were your own responsibility. Everyone had to leave from the same starting spot. And the ultimate destination was a place called the Portofino Inn in Redondo Beach, California. And it really captured people's imaginations. Like, even if you weren't a racer or a car nut, it was just the idea of the spectacle of racing flying across the country. Fastest coast-to-coast time in a Cannonball Run was set in the very last one in 1979. Made it in 32 hours and 51 minutes.
Wow.
And that is fast. That was an average speed of 87 miles an hour.
Whoa.
Yeah, from all the way across the country, 3,000 miles.
And that's average. You know they went way above. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And largely after the publicity and popularity of that last race is what kind of triggered Hollywood Ken Calling and came to Brock Yates. And he agreed to let them use the name for the movie. And they also sort of decided, you know what, this is too high profile now. We need to shut down the Cannonball Run. Because at this point, cops are going to be on the lookout. The whole nation. Yeah. Right. Okay. So Cannonball Run retires. After the last Cannonball Run, after they retired it, one of the racers who had run a couple of the earlier races decided, no, we need to continue this tradition going. So his name was Rick Doherty. And what he did is he created a race called the U.S. Express, which was functionally and spiritually almost the same as the Cannonball Run, right? Yeah, you're leaving from New York or Connecticut, racing down to California. So in the first U.S. Express in 1980, Rick Doherty, his driving partner ended up being none other than Chris knows
Will Wright, creator of SimCity and The Sims and other such fine video games.
Were they friends?
They were. Well,
they were. They knew each other through the circle. Apparently, each of them
The racing circle.
Yeah. Yep. 83 was the last year they had it. But by the last year of the U.S. Express, the coast to coast, the fastest official coast to coast time was down to 32 hours, 7 minutes. After this last U.S. Express, a lot of the coast-to-coast driving attempts, they got really serious about it. And it got less and less about the kind of the fun wackiness of a group race into dedicated single teams doing single-team driving records.
You do training.
Secretly, highly illegal, lots of preparation. I mean, and I'm talking about modifying the car, larger gas tanks, you know, radar detectors. Once they became available, GPS. Mm-hmm. So that last record from the 83 U.S. Express stood until 2006. When a racer named Alex Roy and Dave Marr broke that record, 31 hours and 4 minutes. They waited almost a year to announce this, mainly because they wanted to wait for the statute of limitations to expire on all of the traffic violations that they most assuredly broke along the way.
Yep.
Just a few months ago, the record was broken again.
Oh, really?
By a big margin. Driver Ed Bolian and his two-man support team, they completed the trip in 28 hours.
Wow. Oh, man.
50 minutes.
So they're the only people who've done it under 30 hours. Basically.
They are the only people who claim to have documentation of doing it sub 30 hours. Yeah. Right. In interviews, they've asked Ed Bolian, they said, you know, like, what's the hardest part? Is it going without the sleep? Is it having to pee? And he said it was the preparation. They modified the car. They took out the back seat so they could fit a 67-gallon gas tank in this car. They had multiple GPS units. They had a police scanner. They had radar detectors. They had a laser jammer for jamming laser speed detection. They had a CB radio so they could listen to truckers talking. And on a couple occasions, they would impersonate truckers, actually, to help trucks get out of their way.
Nice.
Yeah, they would get on the CB.
Smart.
Yeah, and like, hey, you know, can you move aside for me? Yeah, right. Again, these are not legal modifications to your car.
There's so much gas in that car, and they're going so fast. What if they had a car accident?
There are a lot of people who really say this is a shameful activity. We shouldn't be glorifying. They could have killed people. They could have hurt people. Fortunately, nobody has ever been injured. There have been no serious accidents in any of these coast-to-coast attempts. Yet.
Right.
Fair point. Fair
now,
point.
To be fair, they are really, 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 really good at driving.
They said that one of the biggest keys to their success was they had scout cars and lead cars. So they knew the route they were going to take, and they had enlisted friends and associates to drive at various periods, 100 or 200 miles ahead of them. They only waited a few weeks to announce their record. And so it is still right now actually a little bit of an open question of, is it possible some jurisdiction somewhere may decide to come after them? But I'd like to wrap all of this up by looking at how far we've come in less than 100 years. So, I mean, I think it bears repeating that none of these records would be possible today if it weren't for the interstate highway system. Even though there were pieces taking shape earlier, it wasn't until 1956, the Interstate Highway Act was signed into law by President Dwight Eisenhower, who really felt, you know what, the nation needs a coordinated interstate highway system for many reasons. Mm-hmm. Going way back before that, one of the early experiments happened in 1919. The U.S. Army conducted an experiment to see, is it even possible to drive coast to coast? So the Army sent out a convoy of trucks from Camp Meade, Maryland, driving to San Francisco, California. The trip took them 2 months.
Wait, when was this?
With an average speed of 7 miles per hour in 1919. Now, to be fair, it was a convoy of trucks and their army trucks.
Yep, they all have to stay together. Yes. They have to go with the pace of the slowest one.
And the officer in charge of this convoy experiment, a young Dwight Eisenhower.
Okay. So he's like, we need some roads.
He had a vested interest from decades back.
It was a long 2 months.
It was a long 2 months at 7 miles an hour. This? So that is the long and yet fast story of coast-to-coast driving in America. I can imagine the next benchmark, someone's going to try and get it under a day.
What if someone needs to poop?
I
know everybody's asking that question in their heads. What do you
adult
do?
Diapers.
Adult diapers?
They said that they brought bedpans with them just in case they needed them. It sounds like they didn't need to use them.
Probably.
It's not nice for their cool guy status. I pooped in
a tray. They'll tell you all about every single law they broke, but as to whether or not they used bedpans, they did, they're probably not going to make that in the official report. Yeah. Of course, we here on Good Job Brain have no need for your Earth cars because we are in possession of a time machine. As you know, constant listeners, if you've been following along the past couple of weeks. Not just any time machine.
The fancy and ridiculous time interloper system, the FARTIS.
Yes, has been stolen by our nemesis, international thief, Carmen Sanmateo. Carmen and the hoodlums in her gang, supermodel and cat burglar Haida Clue, have stolen.
It's so good.
It's just so good. Last time we got a tip from Macapella, the non-instrumental, non-infringing musical group, that we had to solve
an
anagram. There was an anagram, and the words of the anagram were "Hi, 9 rice nibbler."
Yep.
And they let us know that we would have to figure out how to anagram that into a famous 4-word phrase used by a United States president in a speech.
And thanks to listeners who, lots of you guys solved this. This is tricky because the anagram is not in English.
It was not in English. It was an anagram of a 4-word phrase in German.
Yes.
And that phrase turned out to be, as again, many of you got, "Ich bin ein Berliner."
Yeah.
Uttered by John F. Kennedy, means "I am a citizen of Berlin." Now, there was an actually here, because a lot of people think that he actually made a mistake, that he should have said "Ich bin Berliner," and that "Ich bin ein Berliner" means "I am a jelly donut."
Yes.
It would actually, if he really wanted to say "I am a jelly donut," that is what he would have said. And of course, if you actually listen to the recording of the speech, they don't laugh at him; they applaud him. They didn't think it was a funny joke. Luckily, we were able to enter in the correct date, which was
0626-1963, and that's June 26th, 1963.
Punching that into the emergency backup FARTIS, we were off to scenic Berlin, Germany in the 60s. This is what transpired when we got there.
Today, in the world of freedom, the proudest boast is, "Ich bin ein Berliner."
Ah! Brain people! Oh, you found me. You must have also deduced what I was after all this time. Lincoln, Kennedy, the two American presidents share too much in common for it to be a coincidence. Lincoln was elected in 1860. Kennedy was elected in 1960. Both of them had vice presidents named Johnson. Lincoln was shot in Ford's Theater while Kennedy was shot riding in a Ford Lincoln. If I could figure out what connected these two men, I could become president and then steal all of America's gold! Can you believe that Carmen called me crazy? She said something about confirmation bias, and then she ditched me here in Berlin and took off in the Fardis. Maybe she's got a bigger plan, but I really thought that my scheme was perfection. A better, easier scheme, but it really takes higher devotion and youthfulness. Anyway, you might have caught me, but you'll never catch Carmen. Not unless you find the clue that I hid in that last sentence.
All right.
I feel like we're getting close.
Well, I mean, first of all, we were able to apprehend
Hide a clue. Yeah.
She is in.
She sounds kind of familiar.
She's in trivia jail.
In a weird way. Yeah. But what did she say?
Yeah, her scheme was pretty bad.
She's cray-cray.
Yeah.
And you know what? She should have aimed for 2060 if she was going to keep the pattern. Right.
Yep, true. Well...
The two presidents were assassinated. Like,
does she want that?
Yeah, also true. I really don't know what the plan was.
All the beauty, but not a lot of brains.
Yeah, stealing America's gold. I think she thought that if you become president, you just get to walk into Fort Knox and walk out with the gold.
Right.
I don't know. I don't know what she's thinking.
It's inside the mind of a dangerous criminal. You know,
but we still need to get Carmen San Mateo. And luckily, true to her name, hit a clue for us.
What did she say? A better, easier scheme, but... It really takes higher devotion and youthfulness. Interesting. All right.
It's a weird bit of phrasing, for sure.
A better, easier. Not a better and easier, but a better, easier scheme.
A better, easier scheme.
But it really takes higher devotion and youthfulness.
Well,
all right.
There's something in there.
All right, listeners. You guys got to help us out. Of course, we'll update our Fardis on the website, and you can... If you know the code, you can punch it in and see if we can track Carmen San Mateo down. And that is our show, everybody. Thank you guys for joining me, and thank you guys, listeners, for listening in. Hope you learned a lot of stuff about fast things, instant noodles, Cannonball Run, FedEx, and you can find us on iTunes, on Stitcher, on SoundCloud, and on our website, goodjobbrain.com. Thanks to our sponsor, lynda.com, and we'll see you guys next week.
Bye.